Isn't it true? It, when I saw that thing, immediately I took it up to my office and had my secretary make a copy, because it's so simple, it just hits you, you see. They all claim they follow the man who said love, and then they all hate each other. Well, I think this cartoon's rather significant, because I happen to feel, ladies and gentlemen, now again, you make your own decisions, but if you take the Bible seriously, and we said the other day, the big principle today is be honest, then just take it seriously. And don't overlook the statements of Jesus Christ in which he pleaded for unity. Now, we seem to underscore those statements where he says, have pure doctrine and so on. We've underscored those and we've ignored the others. We really have. Are we as passionate to get together with that church down the street because they are also Christians as we are to maintain our own? Now, all you got to do is read John 17, ladies and gentlemen, where Christ says that, where he prays the last evening of his life, that his followers might be one, that they might be as closely united, the Presbyterians and the Lutherans and the Methodists and the Roman Catholics, as he and the Father are one. That's awfully close. And some of you read what I wrote recently when somebody wrote into our denominational paper, which is more important, to do evangelism or to get the churches together? And my answer simply was, which wheel on a bicycle is more important? We're all in favor of evangelism. Christ said just as much about his followers being united. So when I speak of this, I hope, I shall even try, usually I try the opposite, I shall even try to speak of it with passion, with concern. This isn't an academic subject now. When you talk about ecumenism, I think you are following the wishes, the last will of Jesus Christ. And I don't see how anybody can talk about that without some concern and emotion. Now, this is basic. If you're not sure that Jesus Christ said this in John 17, well, then maybe you aren't as concerned about it as I think we ought to be. Now, there are several possibilities that have been presented today. I want to show them to you. There are men who are working on this almost day and night, you see. Almost day and night, asking, how can we work together? If we don't, we're just sunk. I happened to be at a meeting in Detroit, several years ago already, the question of rural churches. Now, anybody who knows rural areas knows what's happening. There's a little Methodist, a little Presbyterian, a little Lutheran, none of which is big enough to support itself, and so they all close up hating each other. There's nothing left. Well, at least let these three become Presbyterians, and these three Methodists, and these three Lutherans, and you've got some Christians. And if you realize that worldwide we're just losing out so fast that by the year, 2000, about 6% of the world will be Christians, from 19 to 6%, ladies and gentlemen, something wrong. Now, there are people who are deeply concerned who are saying one of the answers is that the Christians learn to work together, so that when we go to India, we don't make them Presbyterians or Lutherans, we confront them with Jesus Christ. And there are two suggestions today which I think have real merit. And I can best present these to you, I think, here. One of them comes from Gibson Winter, who said this is the only possibility that he sees. Here is the big megalopolis, whether it's Chicago or Los Angeles, who cares? And now you have all these little churches in here, and none of which can really be flourishing anymore. And he suggests that you have one church here in the center. Why? Because down here you've got the inner city. You've got the poor. And out here you've got the rich profession. And they all ought to belong to one church. Now, this is a Christian church. If
one denomination wants to have a separate service at 8 o'clock, that's all right. But it's one building, so you don't have to keep up 18 building plants, you know. Waste all your money fixing the roof. And then the building stands idle. No, here's one really good building. I have to believe that the church can't get along without buildings. I think today you need it. Some of you were in my reading group where Stephen Rowe says get rid of all buildings. I don't see how you can, but at least let's up. But we don't need 18 of them. Each one with a budget of its own. You have one here where you have a psychiatrist, let's say, for those who are mentally ill. Not every pastor is a psychiatrist. You have one youth expert who can really help these kids down here. Most of us don't know how to help them. And if this fellow down here needs this old grandmother needs a medic and she doesn't have any money, she calls the church, and the church calls Dr. So-and-so over here and says, when can you take her? She's a fellow Christian, same church, and so on. She belongs to us. So he takes care of her. The lawyer, the dentist. This is what Christians are to do. We're here to help each other. This has real possibilities, I think, for the future. This already is going to be tried, so to say, in Columbia, Maryland, where there's going to be, you know, this new city growing up, and there's going to be one church. We serve them all. The other comes from Stephen Rose, World Council of Churches, who sort of takes what we've got now. You know, here's a city with churches all over the place. And not very well planned. There are three churches here, and then for a mile and nothing. Well, he says, keep them. But each church becomes a specialty of its own. Each building. Now this building here, let's say it's a Lutheran church, beautiful, half a $1 million structure. Well, that's the church for education. That's where all the people go who want some education. And here's where the experts are. This church here, let's say Methodist, that's for the old folks. This is just set up now. They can go there and they want to make quilts or play cards or drink coffee. Wonderful. And there's an expert there in geriatrics who can deal with the old folks. This one here is a Presbyterian, and this becomes the center for the nervous, what do you call them, mentally ill, emotionally disturbed people. So you've got that expert there. And this one here, let's say, is for preschool. Here's where parents go and say, now, how do we bring up our kids? They're all under four yet, but and you get some expert help. So you keep what you got, but it really becomes an ecumenical church. Now you may say, well, we ought to fight this. That's up to you. I think if we keep fighting much longer, we'll all be like Harlem or Manhattan, it will be anything. And so we've really served the world, you know, 268 denominations all hating each other. Now, if this is coming, and I'd be willing to bet you a steak dinner that it is, that and even the Roman Catholics will participate in this. I think all of you read in the Associated Press, we're in Kansas City, a new church was built. Who built it? Roman Catholics, Presbyterian, United Church of Christ, and one other, Episcopalians. One building. Now, we can do it in the Army, in Vietnam. I think our situation here is just about as bad. Now, if this happens, and I think it will, without a doubt, I think it's going to happen much faster than we realize, what do we have to contribute? I like to put it that way. There are some people who say, all right, and you give up all principles, all your faith, and it just becomes sort of a conglomeration, and everybody talks about being kind to grandma, and that's about all the Christian faith will be. No, I think we have a real responsibility here, and by that I mean all of us. Now, I hope before this period is over, we can ask you, you're Methodist, right? No, what are you?
United Church
of Christ. That you might tell us what you feel your church can contribute. And if there's a Presbyterian here, I think this is important. Because we talk about self-identity. You really aren't a human being until you have seen yourself as to what you are and what you can be. Well, that's true of a church. Now,
I'm afraid if we'd asked this morning, I don't want to be ugly, but if we'd ask you this morning, most of us are Lutherans, what is the peculiar contribution that the Lutheran Church can bring to this? What shall we just say? Well, we sort of disappear in the crowd? Absolutely not. I think the Methodists have a contribution to bring. I would call it social sensitivity. The Methodists are superb in it. It bothers me. You can go uptown, talk to a Methodist preacher, and he'll say, what do you think we ought to do with those boys down in jail? What boys? He's been down there 10 times because the cops brought in a whole batch of boys 12 years old stealing out of railroad cars, or Mariana, or whatever. We Lutherans, we haven't even heard of it yet. The social sensitivity of the Methodists, I think, is superb. I'd like to learn this from them. I wish they'd show us how. I really do. When I think of the Greek Orthodox, this endurance which they have, even in Russia and in this country, they're a little group, but they know how to worship, folks. You just go there sometime. It's an odd kind of worship to us. But don't forget, when the Lutherans and the Catholics in Germany were persecuted by Hitler, they folded up. What was left after 5 years? Practically nothing. Any German would agree on that. Practically nothing. And in Russia, the Greek Orthodox have been persecuted since 1917, and they don't give up. What have they got? I'd like to get some of this. I wish I could learn from the Presbyterians how to engage in politics wisely. They know how to do it. They're always up there. Well, it's our job to influence the public conscience. And they're really not big numerically in this country, but the Presbyterians are always in power seats. I wish I could learn some of it. We sort of step back and don't get our fingers dirty. Now, I purposely say this as a preface, lest somebody think, well, I'm a Lutheran and only the Lutherans have something to contribute. No, it's like Holden Village. I'm glad there's some cooks, and I'm glad there's some guys who take care of other things. And when we all work together, what a beautiful life this is. Now, if I had to cook, you wouldn't stay very long. But maybe I can help in this way. Now, it's the same thing in the ecumenical church. There's some things I wish I could learn from Rome. It's their emphasis on worship. 6 o'clock in the morning, they go. Now, it may be an empty form sometimes, but I wish we could learn this. This appeal of worship. And you can make your own list here. Now, we are here as largely as Lutherans, and like I said at the end, if some of you want to contribute, please do. Now, I had to speak recently to a national club of educators. The point was, shall we still put out Sunday school material as Lutherans? Why, I'll bet you the Lutherans in the last few years have put in $4 million into this. Now, why don't we just use some of the other material? Is there any difference? $4 million is $4 million. Just think what that could have done among starving people. Now, have we anything distinctive to contribute? And if so, what is it? And I was asked to speak on this to all these experts, and oh, that I were. Because you can't just get up and say, well, now, we Lutherans, we like to sing. Well, of course we like to sing, but that's not particularly distinctive. And so I'm going to just share some of this with you. I found it very difficult. Extremely difficult to say, this is uniquely Lutheran. This is what we ought to bring to this ecumenical church. And I quoted E. Clifford Nelson, formerly dean of Luther Seminary in St. Paul, who just got so angry about some of this that he resigned because the Lutheran church wasn't going fast enough in that direction. Well, at least he's concerned. Who said at Helsinki at our Lutheran World Convention, I heard him say it, it's rather strange that after 1900 years, the church is still wondering what it is. We are today more self-conscious about being Lutheran than we were 50 or 70 years ago. Now, what is it that we can bring to this marriage, so to say? It's coming, unless you want to fight it, that's your privilege. I happen to think it's coming, and I personally believe the Christian thing is to ask, now, what can we bring to this? We don't want this to be lost. It's so precious. Just as the Greek Orthodox, I hope, will say, oh, don't give up your worship, because we've learned through the centuries how important this is. Now, what is it that we can contribute? Well, what is distinctively Lutheran? When I finished with this, a Missouri Synod professor said, may I have your address and take it home with me and correct it? And I gave it to him. It came back. It didn't have one red mark in it. Because all I said to him is, when you correct it, be sure you document it. Don't just say, I think. You know, that doesn't mean anything. You prove it out of writings or something. And I've seen him since, and he said, Strang, I sure tried to cut that thing out. Well, it just, I think, shows you how difficult this is. I deliberately quoted a Missouri Synod professor from St. Louis who said, Lutherans don't agree on the inerrancy of the Bible. Now, we had some of this last night. I don't think anybody questions it, but we just don't agree on it. So you can't say, now, the Lutherans ought to bring into this ecumenical endeavor an emphasis on the Bible. Well, the others have it too. This isn't particularly, I think, I'm just trying to be honest. Prove it. There isn't one Bible commentary in the country put out by Lutherans. If we think the Bible is so important, they're all put out by some of the others. The Methodist Abington Press put out the wonderful international commentary. So I don't think we think any less of the Bible than some of the others. But neither am I ready to prove, at least I can't really prove. I like to think it, you know, it sort of swells my ego. But I don't think you can say that we have a better emphasis on the inerrancy and the importance of the scriptures. You might say, and sometimes we hear chaplains say this, well, Lutherans have something in that confirmation class, you know. Well, it depends upon your point of view. I don't know. If you again read Lenski's book, you remember we referred to that first week, that the more we educate, the more narrow people become. That's Lenski's discovery. The more narrow we become about Negroes and all this sort of thing, Jews, the more we Lutherans educate, the more we hate the Jews. Well, that isn't always a good thing then. And I don't know, I have no proof in any educational study that we do a better job of educating, because a lot of the other churches have something like confirmation class. And we today seem to be a little worried about this thing, confirmation. We're all studying it. I'd be very happy to discuss it with you. Every major Lutheran body that I know of in the world is asking, shall we continue this type of confirmation that we have, you know? There's nothing in the New Testament about a confirmation service. And we're all worried about it. Nobody has the answer. But where does the Bible say at age 14 you've got to be confirmed? What is confirmation? Nobody knows. Really? The right. Now, the instruction, yes, I think we would all say, that's wonderful. We don't want to give it up. Most of our church bodies have gone from 2 to 3 years. But I don't see how we can say that this is particularly unique. Well, the others do it in other ways. And when it comes to some of their material, it's certainly just as good as ours, and maybe super. If you're honest, if you get into an ecumenical meeting and say, listen, we're just better in this respect, they just knock you over so fast. And you can't prove it, really. I don't think that... well, you might say, but we have parochial schools. Yeah, but we don't have one postgraduate school in the country, a Lutheran. When boys in our seminaries, this is not pleasant to say, but it's true. When a boy gets through the seminary and wants to go on for his doctor's, there isn't a Lutheran school in the country he can go to. Not one. Princeton, Presbyterian, Harvard was what? Congregational. And we don't have a... So though we may have a few more parochial schools here, and that's under question right now, we have nothing at the top, so we can't say, well, we are the best educators among them. I don't think, unless you can... you can give me some actual proof you can say, well, we Lutherans, we have something here. I wish we did. I really do. But we don't, as far as I can see. You might say, well, it's our view of the Lord's Supper that's distinctive, that's unique, that we ought to bring in here. Now, let's be a little stubborn when we get into the ecumenical movement and say, well, we don't care how you build that building. We Lutherans have no Lutheran architecture. But we insist that you believe in the real presence in the Lord's Supper. Well, we're not the only ones who believe that. You could get a book called Marburg Revisited. Marburg, because that's where Luther and Calvin had some discussions. And we just finished with some really important meetings out east. And, I handed these out free of charge to my seniors, because I felt it was so important, where some Lutheran and Presbyterian theologians had met for quite a few meetings on what are the differences among us in the Lord's Supper. You can get it. It's put out by the National Council of Church, National Lutheran Council. And they agreed, and there were men on there like Quanbeck, some of you know that name, Martin Heineken, and so on, and then the Presbyterians on there, and they agreed, it's the last page, saying that as far as we can tell, that there is really no basic difference between us except in terminology. Yet we just use different words, but we mean the same thing. Now, he's a pretty big man. Quanbeck is in the Lutheran World Federation Commission on Theology. He wouldn't sign something unless he can pretty well defend it, because he knew he'd be attacked. So this isn't what's really distinctive. Or we might say, well, justification by faith. This is what Lutherans have, and this gives us a right to a separate existence. I have a colleague by the name of Bodensieck, a brilliant man, who told me the best book he'd ever read on justification by faith was written by Hans King, a Roman Catholic, or Karl Rahner. Well, that doesn't mean that the Roman Catholics have accepted it. I think there's a real distinction here between Lutherans and Roman Catholics, but not among Protestants, you see. Calvin accepted justification by faith. In fact, he accepted the whole Augsburg Confession, he said. It was all right with him. In fact, he was very highly in favor. Frankly, if you're honest, now you can disprove this, but if you're honest, I don't think you can say that we are the only ones who believe we're saved by grace. That's what justification by faith means. The Methodists sing it, they say it, they mean it. They say it in little different ways. And you may say, but I know of some Methodist who da-da-da, doesn't believe it. Well, I know of some Lutheran too, you know. Those individual cases, I don't think, mean too much. Well, let me skip some of this. What then is distinctive? If you want to become a little more theological, you might say, well, Luther has a really wonderful view of creation. That first article, you know, is pretty rare. I believe that God has made me and all that exists. Really, if we'd have stuck to that, we'd have avoided all this argument about evolution. Luther doesn't go into it. God has made me and all that exists, and I'm responsible to God. That's what Genesis is about. Wonderful. But again, if you read Teilhard or some of these others, they have pretty much the same. Well, what is distinctive? Now let's be positive. What do we have to contribute? I'm rather eager that when this happens that we contribute the right thing. And we have to make a decision, ladies and gentlemen, because we're here. To live is to decide, as Sartre would say. And now what is it that we can accentuate? in this ecumenical movement, and we let others accentuate their good points. For one thing, this is now distinctive. I think I can defend this. For one thing, the Lutherans make quite a distinction between law and gospel. Well, hardly anybody else talks about this, and we always talk about it. Just here, the last 2 weeks, I've heard it at least five times that Lutherans make quite a distinction between law and gospel. We sort of get it from Luther. And whether it's still good, still valid, I don't know. I really don't. I've gone from one to the other. Now, there was a man here recently who was had a very heavy emphasis on that. And then I hear someone else who says, well, this distinction was good in the 16th century. It isn't too good anymore today. I really don't. I may as well be real frank with you. Right now, I wouldn't defend it vehemently. I wouldn't try to knock it over. I've just heard too many sides on this. There is a distinction, however. There's no question about it. And this may help you a little bit. One of the main objections that Lutherans have to a great man, let's say like Karl Barth, who is a Reformed, he's not Lutheran, is that Barth will start with the commandment and he will do what Luther says. Now the commandments, if you study them long enough and you realize how sinful you are, they lead you to the cross. But now Barth goes on and says, now that you're a Christian, I ought to keep the commandments. So you've got something above the cross. And here I say, good Lutherans object and say, no, there's nothing above the cross of Jesus Christ. Nothing. And this was really a part of our discussion the other night. I'm concerned about this. I don't want to argue. I want to help. And you help me. But you see, in one of the questions we got in the other night about rules, I just happen to think there's nothing above the cross. Now, Barth says there is. He's Reformed. And I personally, maybe because I grew up with it, but I'm not so sure anymore that this is Lutheran, you see, because we took a survey. Oh, this was 3 years ago already, but I don't think it's changed. We took a survey of Lutheran pastors as to how they teach the catechism. And do you know that 52% have changed the order? They don't start with the commandments. They start with the creed, most of them, or baptism. The point being, they don't start with the commandments anymore. 52%. Just think, they react to a book. They just change a book. Think how deeply they feel to go up to a class and say, we're going to start with page 22 rather than page 1. This must be a pretty deep conviction. Now, when my students ask me, how would you start? I really have to tell them today, I don't know. Because, first of all, you've got this big movement. Why start with the commandments, you know? This is Exodus 20. You take one little chapter out of the Old Testament and blow it way up. What about Isaiah? You never get to that. That's the one that Jesus quoted, or even Genesis, or the Psalms. No, we take one little section. If you took one little section out of my book and said, this is the only thing that's important, I think I'd object a little bit. I'd say, well, you've got to read the rest if you want to understand that. But there are so many Lutheran pastors today who say, well, maybe this was all right in Luther's day, but we won't do it anymore today. Sometimes I feel, well, why always hit people over the head, especially with adults? But then Martin Marty writes a book, I think it's over here, called The Hidden Discipline, in which he says, no, you ought to start with the commandments. And all I'm trying to show you today is that this is a real tension, and if you have the answer, let me tell you, you're an extremely wise man, because I have quotations here from Reagan Prenter and so on, where they say, we just don't seem to know whether this is still the best approach or not. I think I'd have to say, at this moment, I wouldn't start with the Ten Commandments, because we, the church, we've given the impression so much to the public, This is the place where you get the Ten Commandments. You ask the man on the street, who doesn't belong to church, what's your image of the church? He'd say, well, that's where they tell you, thou don't commit adultery, don't steal, da-da-da-da-da-da. Always negative. And we've given that impression so much. When you've got topless waitresses in San Francisco, who speaks up? Some bishop. This is awful. Again it. Why doesn't he do something positive once? And say, let's get busy and help these poor duffers down here. No, the church is known as being again it. Again this, we're again this, we're again this, and we're going to hit you over the head. That's really not the impression that Jesus gave to people. And so I think I'd have to say at this moment, here I may change tomorrow, and I'm not ashamed of this. It's part of the tension. Today I would say I don't think I'll begin with the Ten Commandments. And there are quite a few others who would agree with it, 52%. they must have a reason. In other words, I'm saying while the law and gospel distinction is, I think, peculiarly looser, I'm not sure it's still valid. You have to make your decision. Number two, what's distinctively Lutheran is our adherence to the confessions. Now, in my book, some of this is very good. Some of this is very good. I think that in Luther's catechism, we do have something. I don't like the method, statement, question, answer. But what's there? The Heidelberg Catechism has been changed so often that when you ask somebody, do you use it, they'd say, yeah, we use the edition of 1784. There's so many changes. Here, Luther gave us something worthwhile, I think. Whether we want to, keep the order or not, but we do have a loyalty to our confessions. Now, I think, as E. Clifford Nelson recently said, we hold them so tight we squeeze them to death, our confessions. It can very easily become a weakness that when the question comes up, what's the church? We quote Augsburg Confession number 7, where the word is rightly taught in it. Yeah, but the Bible is more important, the Methodists will say. Why don't you go back to the Bible? And our graduates have real problems here. I'll be very frank with you. Seminary graduates, young pastors, have a real problem because in their ordination, they vow loyalty to the confessions. And the confessions say that Mary was always a virgin. She never had any other children. Well, now the New Testament pretty well proves the other. The confessions say that we have three sacraments. Baptism, communion, and confession. Confession of sins. And now you confess loyalty and then you don't believe it. And our young fellows have real problems here. They say, well, can you vow loyalty to the confessions with your fingers crossed? When part of it you don't believe, and I don't know what's going to happen here. But of the third one and the last one, here I'm quite sure. The major contribution, as I see it, and you feel free to correct this, is a hope the Lutherans will bring into this ecumenical movement what Luther called a theology of the cross, which in my book is one of the most beautiful things ever discovered. If I had to say what was distinct, what did Luther really discover, I wouldn't say justification by faith. Others got that too. And at Helsinki, that was even stated officially. Justification by faith is not the main doctrine in the Bible. It talks just as much about love. Now maybe in 1530 you had to emphasize. That's all right. And I don't deny it. But we no longer say it's the one thing because it isn't. But there's one aspect of Luther's theology, and I think Lutherans have had it, I wish we had it more. It's just being, I think, rediscovered by this tremendous Luther study that's going on today. And I'd like to just, for 8 minutes yet that I have, share this with you, because this is so choice that I'm sure I smiled in my study when I finally caught on what was really meant, even though nobody was around. Oh, this is, I think, it's wonderful. What does Luther mean by theology of the cross? When I was at the seminary, I don't remember ever once hearing that phrase. I can only tell you of one book in English by Dillenberger of San Francisco. There are several German ones out. Anybody know German? There's one beautiful one written by a man who came through the concentration camps. The title of his big book is, and I've read it twice, Der angefochtene Glaube. How do you translate that? A faith that's been assaulted, that's been tested, you see. And he came through it. And he said it was Luther's theology of the cross that helped him. And I happen to believe that one of the reasons why you don't have a single Lutheran theologian in the God is Dead movement. Now, we get a lot of good Lutheran theologians in the country. You just string them off from Pelican to Sittler to Stanley and down the line. We got our share. And they're out in the thick of things. But in the God is Dead movement, there isn't one Lutheran. Why? Because I think we got something here that, which if you had, you wouldn't worry too much about the God is Dead movement. Now, what is the theology of the cross? I used to think that means a lot of Lenten service talking about the cross. That isn't it at all. Isn't it at all? Anybody else does that too. What does Luther mean? It comes really from his Heidelberg debate, 1518, where Luther says one reason I can't agree with Calvin is because Calvin has what Luther called a theology of glory and I have a theology of the cross. And the difference between the two, let me quote right from the theses. Luther says, the one who beholds what is invisible of God through the perception of what is made is not rightly called a theologian. I've sensed that here several times. You get an example, an illustration, and you refer that back to God. Somebody here said today, well, God is like my father. No. That's exactly the point of the prodigal son story, that God is different. You don't get an illustration here and draw it back to God. Oh, no. God isn't. My father isn't like the prodigal son's father, and I'm not one. My kid misbehaves, I paddle him. But no, God forgives. God is different. And Luther now says, if you don't know what God is, you don't start here and make comparisons. But rather, the one who perceives what is visible of God, God's backside. Remember Exodus 33, where Moses can see only the backside? By beholding the sufferings and the cross. The theologian of glory calls the bad good and the good bad. The theologian of the cross says what a thing is. Remember that honesty the other day? We don't change a Bible verse to say what I want it to mean. Let it say what it says. And if there's a contradiction, there's a contradiction. Live with it. That wisdom which beholds the invisible things of God as perceived from works puffs up, blinds, and hardens man altogether. Nevertheless, the wisdom is not bad, nor is the law to be fled, that without a theology of the cross, man misuses the best things in the worst way. Let me try and explain this a little bit, because I think this is choice. It has helped me over a rough spot. What does Luther mean by a theology of the cross? Well, I think there are really three aspects to it, very briefly. One of them is a person. Now, I believe we're all theologians. I'm not talking about some guy sitting in an aisle. Whatever your view is, that's your theology. We're all theologians. And a theology of the cross, first of all, I think Luther would very much agree with this, would talk about the hidden God. Luther talked about the Deus absconditus very much. What does he mean by the hidden God? He quotes Isaiah. Truly thou art a God who hidest thyself, O God of Israel, the Savior. Or Proverbs. It is the glory of God to conceal. You see, Luther had quite a problem with this. Calvin could talk about God and God's covenant, you've got to behave. And Luther would start with a babe in the manger. And one day Luther just virtually shouted in his classroom, the way it's written up, talking about God. And he said, God in diapers? God at the breast of Mary? God at a carpenter's bench, God on a cross, who would think to look for him there? Precisely. God doesn't deal with the big, powerful stuff. That's not the way he comes. You look for him in diapers. You don't like it? That's the way our God acts. This is theology of the cross. It's very lowly. That's why, I'm positive, that's why Luther was against this thing called confirmation, you see. He says that's theology of glory. You put a nice robe over a kid, and you put a flower up here, you let him go up and confess. Well, it's the easiest thing in the world. Everybody expects him to do it. And then he comes home, and there's a dinner, and they give him a wristwatch. As Werner Braun said in an article recently, that's when I got my wristwatch. And uncle gives him $5, and this one gives him $10. Wonderful, isn't it nice? That's a theology of glory. Tomorrow morning, when they're telling dirty stories in the locker room, then what? That's hard. Luther would say, why don't you cut out all this nice stuff? Life isn't that nice. The theology of cross says of a thing the way it really is. I really agree with him here, you know. Luther didn't care for big crowds. We always talk about, no, he said Christ dealt so much with the individual, time for the adulteress. We always like put on a show somehow, you see. The Roman Catholic shows, Luther just hated that. He said, why don't you go and look at the babe in diapers? That's the way God acts. The hidden God. You just don't see him. And whenever anybody says, here, this is God, this is the way he acts, Luther would say, oh, no, you don't know. You don't know. Now, one of our modern scholars, Paul Tillich, has taken this up and says God deliberately hides himself today. This is the work of the Holy Spirit. I can give you the quotation, but I think that's a little bit too strong. I don't know. But all I know that if you really study the New Testament and the Old, when does God ever brag, so to say? He could have. He comes in the still, small voice. You think quite a bit about that God hides himself, and you don't have quite as much trouble with the God is dead movement. He isn't dead. Now, this is the way God is, whether you like it or not. Number two, that the theology of the cross is a very heavy emphasis on servanthood. See, Luther gave up a lot of the fancy rigmarole of the Catholic Church. The point isn't that a preacher gets carried around on the streets the way the bishop was. They just take off all that stuff. You're a servant. And if you read some of those stories, how Luther could sit up with a sick child at night, that's what a servant is for. Though we stressed a little bit of that yesterday. Number three, Luther had a very heavy emphasis on what is a German word that everybody uses today, what is called Anfechtung. Now, he was really serious about that. Anfechtung is temptation, affliction, anguish, assaults, trials. He says, without Anfechtung, there is no faith. And what does he mean? Well, in 1530, he said, I would like to write a book about Anfechtung. Without it, no man can rightly understand the Holy Scriptures or know what the fear and love of God is all about. In fact, without Anfechtung, one does not really know what the spiritual life is. In all Anfechtung, we are dealing directly with God. Oh, brother, you get this and you've got something worthwhile. Remember, we said, I think, 2 weeks ago here, how intensely personal the Christian faith is. And once you've had this, it's, I guess, like a good artist who doesn't care to look at fourth-rate stuff. You know, just awful for him, I suppose, because he really knows what good art is. And when you caught this, you get tired of 90% of the stuff in the church because you say, well, where does God come in? Luther says, once you really meet God, then you've been tested. This was his problem, not what verse in the Bible now is authentic and who wrote. Oh, no, that's so secondary. You, once you've met God, you're never the same. What he says, once you've met God, you're immortal. Get it? And we're always talking about a Bible, a church, about stewardship. No, you just face God. And Luther says, you've got real trials. Because, he likes to quote Philip when he said to Jesus, show us the Father. That's a theology of glory. Come on, let's have a miracle here. And Jesus says, who has seen me has seen the Father. That's the theology of the cross. Don't start bragging. Don't make it too big. The theology of the cross is very humble. Now, I happen to think that there are outsiders who almost have seen this better than we Lutherans have. I'm really sorry about it. I'm thinking of writers. John Updike, I think, has seen this. Or T.S. Eliot. And with this, I want to close. T.S. Eliot wrote a little play that I think is theology of the cross pure and simple. He's a Britisher, you know. They see pretty deeply sometimes. He wrote a little play about Mary and Joseph and the baby going to Egypt. It's a one-act play. And, you know, the second or third night out, they're sitting by the fireplace and warming each other, and they start talking about Christmas Eve. And Joseph says, remember, wasn't that beautiful music? And Mary says, oh, boy, all those angels and everything. She starts bragging a little bit. And God did this all for us, you know. And she's bragging a little bit more all the time. And then all the money that the wise men brought, the frankincense and the myrrh, boy, they were never so rich in all their lives. And then the donkey turns his head. It's been standing there. And I suppose Eliot feels, well, if there's a donkey in the Old Testament who can talk, there ought to be one in the New Testament who can talk. And the donkey turns his head and he says, and to think that the whole world rests on my shoulders. That's beautiful theology of the cross. Because this is the way our God acts, you see. He doesn't brag. Really, it's true. If that donkey hadn't gotten them down to Egypt, you and I couldn't be Christians. There would have been no Christ to die for us. And that's the way God acts. Our God suffers. And if a college boy asks me, now how is Christianity different from Buddhism, all the rest? I have only one answer. We are the only religion in the world which has a God who suffers. Buddha doesn't. He sits there looking at himself. Muhammad has pretty sayings. The Christians are the only ones who have a God who suffers. And I think Luther saw this and captured this in what we today simply call a theology of the cross. Well, do you want to correct something, contribute something? Maybe we got 1 minute chat or so. Yeah, please. How can I become a Christian? Oh, I think now I would say, why don't you come and live with us and you'll find out. I don't want to say to him, I'll explain to you the creed, and when you know that and say it, that's it. That's all. I think I'd say, why don't you come live with us? If you want to know how we act, you just come to our house for a while. Now, whether that's 2 weeks or long, I don't know. But I would say, come live with. I think that's exactly what Jesus did to Philip. Come. No, who was it? Come and see. Philip to Nathanael. Just come and see. He didn't give him a lecture. I think I'd have to say, just come live with us Christians. And you see what a test that would be for us. It isn't what we say, it's what we do. I think that's the best way. I really do. Do you have a better one? Always a hard question, but I think we used to say, well, now, if you learn the catechism, well, that's too easy. Or if you were willing to recite the creed. No, why don't you find out? That's why there's this emphasis on the community of faith today. Because we need each other anyhow, even after you are a Christian. This is a little bit theology of the cross again. Don't be too sure of yourself. I'm going to be this and this. I've seen some mighty good people fall. Mighty good people. How about me? I don't know. I better stay a little bit farther down here and with this theology of the cross. I'll just hang on to him and I hope you'll help me. And I'll help you. This is good theology of the cross. Please.
To bury this, when you said that, come and live with us. I have a friend who became a Christian later and come to live with us. She was raised Catholic and wanted to share it with her husband. He must come. He must join the church. Well, he just refused. But and so she just skipped it. She came herself. And pretty soon he asked if he might come with her. And so he started coming. And eventually he took the pastor's
instruction
on becoming a member. He took it three times. Mm-hmm. And then she asked him later, she said, what made you decide to come at last? Because she had taken all her trouble. He says, I just saw what was happening to you and the change that had taken place in you.
Okay.
And that's
both. Yeah, that's it. Well, that's a good one to close on. Thank you.